A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host for this journey into issues facing the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues these organizations are facing. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll wrap up our look at opera companies who have used the festival format in their season. I'll speak with Timothy O'Leary, General Director of Opera Theater of St. Louis, about its season festival later this spring and some of the programs that have helped the company broaden its audience base. We'll also hear from Philip Glass, whose opera The Trial will have its American premiere during the St. Louis Festival.
As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The Curtis Institute of Music has moved into the top 10 in a recently released list of the top music schools in the world, joining Juilliard and Indiana University Bloomington as U.S. schools at the top. Curtis was ranked 8th this year, up from 13th in the list compiled by QS Qual Corelli Simmons. Juilliard maintained its hold on top place, followed by the Royal College of Music, and a tie for 3rd between the Royal Academy of Music and Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. Indiana was in 7th place, moving up from 10th last year. Among other American institutions on the rise were New York University, which moved up to 14th from 22nd, and Yale University, which was ranked 16th. The votes are in New Jersey, and the American Repertory Ballet, MacArthur Theater, and New Jersey Symphony Orchestra are among those topping the lists for favorite dance company, favorite theater to see a play, and favorite symphony orchestra in Discover Jersey Arts People's Choice Awards. Coming in on top in the opera category was the Princeton Festival. NJPAC came in first for favorite larger performing arts center, the Paper Mill Playhouse was named favorite theater to see a musical, and Grounds for Sculpture ranked favorite art museum. Full results can be found at jerseyarts.com. And finally, Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra is opening its historic archives to an online audience with the launch of its archives portal. The orchestra announced this week that visitors will be able to pore over photographs, program books, and other gems from its past, including those documenting the many great conductors and performers who have graced its stage. The portal was supported in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts and can be accessed at archive.pittsburghsymphony.org. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world.
Since its inception in 1976, Opera Theater of St. Louis has focused on a festival model for its annual season, hosting several productions in the spring. Over time, the festival has become known for its pre-performance picnics and also for its commitment to include new works in its seasonal repertoire. To that end, in 2013, the opera company staged its first production in its New Works Bold Voices initiative, which committed to 3 world premieres. That program has been extended through at least 2020. Next year, the company will premiere An American Soldier by Wang Ro and David Henry Wong. In addition, the opera company is one of 26 performing arts organizations selected 2 years ago to participate in the Wallace Foundation study looking into how arts organizations can effectively expand their audiences. With existing programs that bring opera into area bars and offers special events for young opera fans, Opera Theater of St. Louis has used some early research from the study to further expand its reach, this year introducing a kids' club program during Saturday matinees. This year's season, which begins in May, will bring audiences Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito and Puccini's Modern Butterfly, along with The Grapes of Wrath by Ricky Ian Gordon and Michael Corey, and the American premiere of Philip Glass's The Trial, an adaptation of the Franz Kafka novel. With a libretto by Christopher Hampton, The Trial follows the absurd experiences of a man who wakes up on his 30th birthday to find out he is under arrest, and spends the next year trying to find out why and searching for justice. The opera was premiered by Music Theatre Wales at London's Royal Opera House. Opera Theatre of St. Louis recently invited the press to a lunch with Philip Glass to discuss the opera and his other works. We'll hear excerpts from that shortly. But for some background on how Opera Theater of St. Louis has attracted an increasingly diverse audience, I spoke with General Director Timothy O'Leary.
Well, I think there's something exciting about a critical mass of work. work going on at the same time. You know, to be honest, one of our greatest strengths as an opera company is that we have the partnership of the St. Louis Symphony. So we have a tremendous orchestra to accompany all our performances. And so actually our calendar grew out of both the availability of our theater and the symphony in the first place. But over the years, the result of that, which is to say, doing all four of our new opera productions simultaneously in repertory, has been that people reserve the time in their calendars if they live in St. Louis. People plan their travel around being able to get to all four opera productions. And then people travel in from all over the country and beyond in order to be able to pack in. Sometimes people will do all four operas in 3 days, which is possible because of the festival model. So, you know, last year our database of ticket buyers had ticket buyers coming in from, I think, 43 states and 5 continents. But that's two things. It's about critical mass, and then it's about what we're producing. And that's sort of the other side of being a festival company, is that we're not doing old repertory productions that we pull out of a warehouse. We're doing 4 new productions almost every single season, and almost always we're doing not only, you know, beloved classics of the opera repertory, but world premieres, American premieres, new commissioned works that are really meant to help shape the future of the art form. It's part of our mantra as a company to be presenting a season every year that is worth traveling in for.
Well, looking at that aspect of the new works, there's been a real commitment to new works, and in particular American operas. How have you seen that strengthening your seasons and expanding your potential audience?
We have a series now that we call New Works, Bold Voices. And the idea is to commission American composers to create new works based on source material from the modern era. We love the classics of the 18th and 19th centuries, but I think it's safe to say there are enough 19th century stories in the opera canon. And our approach is to be telling stories that resonate with audiences today directly in terms of the subject matter. So, you know, for example, our world premiere of Terence Blanchard and Michael Christopher's Champion opened here in 2013. We just returned from Washington, D.C., where it premiered at the Kennedy Center, thanks to the Washington National Opera. When we performed that work here in St. Louis, it was, I mean, it's called an opera in jazz. It's definitely a genre-bending, I think very forward-looking creation. And in part because of juxtaposition of genres, in part because of its very timely subject matter, and in part because of the sort of existing fan base of the composer Terence Blanchard. When we produced that opera, 43% of our single ticket buyers were new to our database. So that expanded our audience substantially, and it became the best-selling world premiere that we'd ever done, and nearly every single seat for every performance was sold out. And people really noticed, and our statistics bear it out, that it was a much more diverse, younger audience than the one that sort of traditionally comes to opera. The trick there, then, is to have something in future seasons that keep those audiences coming back, and that's been part of our strategy. There's always something new and unusual. So, for example, last season, the world premiere of Shalimar the Clown, based on a Salman Rushdie novel and featuring music by Jack Perla, libretto by Rajiv Joseph, and music that really, again, juxtaposes musical styles, in this case, South Asian classical music with the Western opera tradition, in a way that was just arrestingly beautiful and felt incredibly here and now.
If we take a look at the upcoming 2017 festival season, how do the 4 works that are in that represent that?
This season, we actually have taken one little step forward in that. It's been a long tradition that of the 4 operas in our season, we'll have one that is a new American opera. This season, we have 2 out of the 4. So in addition to Puccini's Butterfly and Mozart's La Clemenza di Tito, two of the greatest operas ever written. We've got two contemporary American masterpieces, in my view. One is Ricky Ian Gordon's The Grapes of Wrath, which we're presenting in a new performing version. Ricky and the librettist Michael Corey went back to their original work, which was nearly 4 hours long and widely acclaimed for its beauty and resonance. But they went back and looked at how they could distill it into a work that would be of more manageable artistic forces and length. And so now the new version will be just about 2.5 hours long, including an intermission, and really distills all the emotion and impact of the original. On the same season, we have the American premiere of Philip Glass's The Trial, which he wrote with librettist Christopher Hampton after a Kafka novel, famous Kafka novel, about really an alternative reality, an absurdist, Kafkaesque alternative reality, in which justice as we know it is not attainable. It's amazing that a novel was written in 1914, but the resonance of the story couldn't feel more contemporary. And really, Philip Glass has become one of the most recognized of all American composers, but specifically a great master of the operatic form. And they, I think, have gotten greater and greater as his career has gone on. He's a master at dramatic pacing and a musical language that invites the audience in. And in this case, it's actually a dark comedy, and it's incredible how funny Philip Glass's music can be.
In addition to the performances, there are also quite a wide variety of other events and experiences that help make Opera Theater of St. Louis and its productions more accessible and kind of more welcoming to a broader group of audiences. You have the Teen Matinee, TGIF Opera, Opera Tastings. Explain a little bit about some of these, and how do you see these bringing in more people and making them feel comfortable?
Our company has, from the outset, been famous among people who love it for a really welcoming style. One benefit of our festival model is that we perform the whole season in May and June, which is beautiful spring weather in St. Louis. And Richard Gaddis, who founded the company, had his early experience at the Glyndebourne Festival, which is famous for its outdoor picnics. That model we imported, so to speak, and every performance at Opera Theater is preceded by this long, beautiful picnic scene in a beautifully landscaped garden that we create every year on our theater grounds. And we have picnic dinners under tents, and you can either come and purchase a catered dinner or just bring anything that you'd like in a sort of tailgate fashion. And this social aspect of coming for a fun, festive, beautiful evening out has been really part of what's driven such loyalty in this audience. By the way, that experience extends after the performance as well, because this is the only opera company that I know of where the whole cast comes out to this sort of outdoor tent after the performance and mixes with the audience. There's no special ticket that you need or donor level that you've got to have in order to have drinks with the artists and chat with them after the performance. It's just always been part of the tradition here. So that tradition is something that we've realized we can build on when it comes to building new audiences. You know, we've been fortunate, thanks to the Wallace Foundation, to be able to do a lot of research on our audience and actually the potential audience, people who haven't really been coming but, you know, might come if they had more information about what we do. And what we found through this research is that people, especially younger people, the sort of young, diverse audience that we're so interested in building for the future, they have stereotypes about opera that are incredibly negative and actually not terribly related to what the experience of coming, at least to Opera Theater of St. Louis, actually is. So a program like Opera Tastings, which is something we do all year round in bars and restaurants all over the region, is meant to introduce the actual, you know, feel and experience of our company to a whole new audience. So we bring four great young opera singers and a great pianist into bars and restaurants and pair the music that they are performing with drinks and food selected by the chefs and sommeliers at these restaurants that complement the flavors of the music, we say. So the result is a fun, compact evening in which people learn all about the history of opera and all the different styles of music in it. But what they're really having is a really fun, engaging social experience that leads them to want to discover more. So we're finding lots of ways to offer these entry points, whether it's our Young Friends program, which offers a sort of package deal of a buffet dinner before the performance in a tent that's reserved for younger audiences, or this TGIF opera program, which provides an after party on Friday nights, including surprising musical entertainment and food and drink after the show. These are just all ways to help people into what is actually a really fun, enjoyable evening, especially if they're not people who have thought of themselves as opera goers in the past.
And actually, this year marks the launch of a new program actually designed at, I guess, the even younger set, shall we say, the Kids Club, which will be for children ages 3 to 12. And I take it that kind of seems to be a, kind of have a dual purpose. On the one hand, it's a help and a service for parents who want to go, but it's also, I would presume, giving some of these children a taste of what they can do when they grow up.
Kids Club is the, you know, it's been a long-held idea in the performing arts, but if we could just provide free babysitting, you know, that all the parents of children who would like to come but find the childcare an obstacle will come. Well, we've offered specially priced family matinees and that kind of thing for years, and that's about bringing your children to the opera. So when we do a piece like The Magic Flute, that's been incredibly popular. But the Kids Club is a different idea. It's, you know, please come to the opera, but we'll take your kids. Doing that sounds like an easy thing on paper, but then the devil's always in the details. So we realized, well, actually, we have had for decades a great program called Opera Camp, which provides like a week-long immersion in all the elements that make up opera for a few hundred kids from our region each year. Well, Kids Club is a way of giving parents the opportunity to drop off their kids for a single afternoon at an opera camp-like experience. So the kids get a really fun afternoon. The parents get to go to the opera, which means they can go to whichever opera, whether it's suitable for the children or not. And then actually, the kids and the parents are, you know, kind of equipped for the car ride home, because the parents are given things to ask their children about that they did at the little one-day opera camp that they attended. So we're really optimistic that this will help unlock one of the major challenges in the performing arts and live performance attendance. You know, one of the challenges in the way audiences work nowadays is that people's lives have changed. People get married later, have children later. So when people are in their prime years for attending the performing arts, they're busy with children and lots of obligations. So arts organizations need to change with the times as well.
One tool that you've had recently is, thanks to a grant from the Wallace Foundation, the ability to really do real research into so many of these different aspects. What's an example of one or two ways that you're taking this data and making it work?
The Wallace Foundation's Building Audiences for Sustainability program is something we're just so grateful to be a part of. We're one of 26 arts organizations all over the country that, thanks to this grant, are able to conduct detailed research into what audiences are interested in, especially potential audiences. In our case, we chose the target demographics of millennial and Gen X audiences with an emphasis on diverse audiences. So the first step was to understand what the people in those categories actually know about us and what their impressions are. That took the form of quantitative research and qualitative research, which is to say hours and hours of focus groups that were incredibly revealing about how people interact with our messaging and with our company itself. Of course, one of the things that we discovered, not to our surprise, but it was very helpful to have the information, was that just a lot of people in those demographic categories have very little awareness that a company like ours exists, or if they are aware of it, they have impressions of it that are really very different from what the company is. And so we were able to invest in a major awareness campaign that emphasizes the aspects of the experience that we know people find most welcoming, which is to say it's not an overly formal evening out. It's preceded by this food and drink experience in the garden, and that, you know, one of our slogans in this campaign is "Make our stories your story." The campaign is actually entirely based on imagery of Snapchat type storytelling, and really provides, through incredibly accessible imagery, a very authentic depiction of what it is like to come to the opera at Opera Theater of St. Louis. That's the kind of thing we would just never have the resources to be able to design well or to implement without the help of the Wallace Foundation. But then there's a lot more. The grant has allowed us to expand our Young Friends program. One of the challenges we were having is that the Young Friends program involves a pre-performance event, which means you need to have space for the events. And the events were consistently sold out, and therefore we weren't able to add any more Young Friends. But we were able to buy a second tent to house more Young Friends during an event. And so the attendance at those events has increased dramatically. Also, we are always working with a group that we call our Engagement and Inclusion Task Force. And this is a group of volunteers, community leaders, from an incredibly diverse range of community organizations and backgrounds. And the whole idea is to help give us advice about building a more diverse audience for opera and our company in particular, which means really understanding what we can do in our community that is viewed as positive.
That was Timothy O'Leary, General Director of the Opera Theater of St. Louis. Having just turned 80 in January, composer Philip Glass shows no sign of slowing down. His operas, which also include The Fall of the House of Usher, Einstein on the Beach, Satyagraha, and Akhenaten, are now regularly presented at opera companies in the U.S. and worldwide. This year will bring 14 productions of his operas in various locations. During his recent lunch with journalists, he shared some of his thoughts about adapting the trial for the opera stage, as well as the state of new opera productions on U.S. stages. The following are some brief edited excerpts from that conversation.
One of the problems with opera, basically, is within usually less than 3 hours, you have to tell maybe a whole, with the story of Gandhi, you have to tell his whole story. So you have to find, or with Akhenaten, you have to find ways of telling a story. You find shorthand shortcuts to tell the story that are not necessarily in the text. And that's where the staging becomes so important. I got a writer who has done a lot of theater work. And I had done a lot of theater work with him. Gave him very few instructions, except I've always said to him that that no words with more than 4 syllables can be sung. 5 syllables, that beautifully cannot be sung. Beautifully. No, don't even try. He argued a little bit about it, but in the end, the only times I've had to edit this was for he does playwriting. He doesn't. The only operas he's done have been with me, but there have been a number of them now, and it's been quite a good libretto since as he's gotten used to just those kinds of limitations. It takes longer to sing than to speak. The first thing we had to do was to find the way of telling the story and capturing the confusion and the bewilderment and the frustration and the sheer agony and of the character, which the way he does it, by making it so funny, it becomes bearable. One of the things that helped me was that I began, my first pieces were theater pieces. I began writing theater music for theater. I began writing dance music when I was a student at Juilliard. The question I asked myself was who wanted the music, and I found out that dance companies wanted music, and theater company didn't have any money, but I didn't have any money either, so money wasn't an issue. My first piece was a play of Molière called Le Scapin, It was done at the Makarta Theater in New Jersey. I remember it to this day. I was paid $25.
Yeah.
And I had to deliver a tape. Finished.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it cost me more than that to make the tape. But that. So even though, when I first came back to New York after my time in Paris and traveling in Asia to some degree, when I came back, I came back to the theater company, the Mambo Minds Theater Company, and I was the resident composer for 20 years. We premiered a number of Beckett pieces, and we knew Beckett from Paris, because we lived in Paris, so we knew him.
Yeah.
So I had been working in the theater for a long time. When people asked me, they said, well, if you're not a minimalist, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a theater composer. And that has the virtue of actually being truthful.
Yeah.
If you add up the ballets, the operas, and the films, they're probably more than 100 pieces altogether. So, and of course, they're okay. There's some symphonies and string quartets. I've done a few other things. But I learned very early how to work in space and in time. Space has to do with dance, and time has to do with theater. So we had a number of things to do. One was to tailor the events of the staging so that the frustration and the intimidation and the persecution of Kay could be fully experienced,
yeah.
but in a shorter frame of time.
One of the struggles, or it seems that you know, opera companies, especially now, are trying to find a balance between they need to bring the audiences in, is it going to be the classics or the newer?
Well,
are you finding them more open as time goes by?
Once they find out that they can sell tickets, they become very open-minded.
Yeah.
It's about that. Sacha Graha was at the Met twice, and it comes back because it sells better than the repertoire. To be put quite bluntly, I mean, once an audience discovers that they like the work, and if they haven't been told by the enemies of the people, I can say by the enemies of music sometimes that they are not going to like this music, and I had to live through that for a long time. But that's, in my case, that's pretty much over. But still, there are many orchestras that won't play music of mine. It's that there's a kind of prejudice, but it's not shared by the people who put on operas. On some years we have 20 productions.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not all new productions, but the secret of having a lot of productions is running a lot of operas. so we're discovering that our income from opera productions is significant.
That was composer Philip Glass. You can find more information on the upcoming production of The Trial and the rest of the Opera Theater of St. Louis's festival at opera-stl.org. I hope you enjoy the conversations I bring you each week on A Tempo and all of the other programs of the award-winning Classical Network. Remember, these programs are possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for joining me for A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. An archive of recent shows can be found anytime at our webcast page at wwfm.org. Join me next week for another look at the changing world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is supported by the listener members of the Classical Network.